The following talk, Public Schools Under Attack, Voucher, Charter, and Virtual, features three panelists: Marge Passman, Vice President of the Madison School Board, Ellen Lindgren, President of the Middleton Cross Plains School Board, and Sandy Pope, Representative in the Wisconsin Legislative Assembly. The talk is moderated by Ted Kinneman, a Madison Institute board member and former school board member in Janesville, Wisconsin. The talk is sponsored by the Madison Institute and held on February 16th at the Capitol Lakes Retirement Center. Ted Kinneman begins an excerpt from an article in The Nation magazine written by Julie Underwood, Dean of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Ted Kinneman.
To start off, I want to read a paragraph that Julie Underwood wrote in The Nation a year ago, because I think it sort of sets the tone for this morning's meeting. So if you'll bear with me, I'll read just one paragraph. She says, "Public schools, ALEC being the American Legislative Exchange Commission, wrote in its 1985 Education Source Book, public schools meet all of the needs of all of the people without pleasing anyone. A better system, the organization argued, would, quote, foster educational freedom and quality, unquote, through various forms of privatization, vouchers, tax incentives for sending children to private schools, and unregulated private charter schools. Today, ALEC calls this choice, and vouchers scholarships, but it amounts to an ideological mission to defund and redesign public schools." So with that, each one of our panelists has been allotted 10 minutes to set forth their ideas on this whole subject of educational privatization. And we will start with Marge.
I've spent 30 years in education in Madison, Wisconsin, and in New York City. I am an unabashed proponent of public schools, period, finished. That's it. Over the years, I've refined what is it that I love most about public schools. And I've said this in the paper, and I've said this to teachers, and I'm going to say it to you, and I'll keep saying it, and someday they'll probably put it on my tombstone. But public schools provide universal access to free education. That's the basis of this country. We were the first country to have universal education. They guarantee equal opportunities for all children. They're the great equalizer in our society. And I say this because my husband and I are the first generation that graduated high school. We're the first generation that graduated college in our families. We're the first generation that went through graduate school. And we were the first generation to actually own a home. What did that to us? The inner city schools of New York City. Yes, inner city schools. What the public schools do, because the public schools take every single child that knocks on our door, bar none, we unify a diverse population. That's our job. And we sure know that our population is diverse. But who can do that best? The public schools. All right? We prepare people for citizenship in a democratic society. Lately, I'm wondering if we do such a great job with that, but we certainly should be doing that. Okay? We prepare people to be economically self-sufficient. You can get an education, but if you can't get a job, we're not doing our job. Public schools improve social conditions by discussing them, analyzing them, and putting something into action. Public schools pass knowledge of all cultures from one generation to the next. We share the accumulated wisdom of the ages of all cultures. And hopefully, if you're really good at what you do, a teacher can instill in our young people a love for a lifetime of learning in a very complex society. If you think about that one, it's amazing how we do it. and we do it. And because of all the other reasons that I've just given you here now, public schools bring a richness and depth to the multicultural life that our country affords us. So why are they under attack? If you don't like what your country is doing, if you don't like what it's saying or what it represents, attack the schools. That's the first thing every dictator does. It's the first thing any tyranny does. You attack the schools. Own the schools and you own the brains of your students. Stalin said that, Hitler said that, Mao Zedong said that. That's what happens. But in a country like ours, where also money talks, if you can make money at the same time, you can actually get rich off the public schools by attacking them. And that's it. And they are. There are schools across this country that are making incredible sums of money from taxpayers and not doing their job. So that's the burden that we carry now here today. This is the discussion we're carrying here today, is why are people attacking the public schools? What it will mean if they succeed? And that's fairly frightening to think about.
I'll try to give you some of the education that I have got in the 18 years that I've been on school board and the last 10 years working with a variety of organizations around the state. Middleton is a little bit different than Madison. We don't have quite the diversity that Madison has. We're gifted the way Madison is with a very good property value, which is key in school funding. But as I've said multiple times, most recently at the State Education Convention, even Middleton can't do everything that it wants to do for its students. Just as Madison has an increasing poverty and diversity challenge, Middleton does as well. People are always shocked. We only have 6,000 kids. We've got about a quarter of what Madison has. But we have 120 kids that are identified as homeless, and nobody believes me when I say that Middleton has homeless children. Our free and reduced lunch numbers have gone up above 20% now. Nobody can believe that either. One of our schools right now has 14 different languages that our English language learner teachers are dealing with. All school districts, including Middleton, which is probably one of the 2% of the 424 school districts in the state, even Middleton has challenges with their school budget. There's a big call for accountability that has been going on, and I think Marge and I both don't shirk from being accountable as school board members and setting goals for our district and for our teachers and our administrators and for ourselves. But the problem is they've been cutting our budget for years and years. And every time I hear somebody say, why don't you run your school district like a business, I have to remind them that I balance the budget every year and that I'm accountable to my taxpayers. We just had a huge referendum in Middleton. We had to convince our taxpayers to add $60 million of debt so we could add on to one of our schools and rebuild one of our middle schools. And we had to work hard for that money. We had to prove to our taxpayers that that was a good thing to do, unlike our state government that can decide to create new committees who don't apparently have accountability and lose millions of dollars while supposedly they're stimulating businesses. So I think we are accountable. I think that we have gone over the edge with testing. Many of you in education know that even in a course as seemingly testable as math, you can only test about a third of the knowledge that the kids get. And what employers are telling us very consistently is we want kids who can think critically. That's a very difficult thing to test. We get tested as school board members all the time by the public about whether or not we can think critically. But it's a very hard thing to test, and yet that's one of the most important characteristics, including showing up on time. But critical thinking skills, being able to think creatively, encouraging kids to have more than one answer to a question, even in math, and especially in math, we're finding, and working together in groups. Now, you can't really test that, but we want our kids to be the kind of citizens that can do that, but also so that they can be good employees. I mean, I think that education is beyond employment, but certainly, like Marge said, we want them to be contributing members. And honestly, the things that are required in tests right now are very, very minimal in terms of what we really want our kids to do and what employees are asking us to do with our kids. So we're spending an incredible amount of time and effort and money on an unfunded mandate around a variety of tests. And Marge,
repeat that, unfunded.
Unfunded mandate. Yep, we have a lot of those. And unfortunately, the tests that until recently and are still going on are the kind of tests, those of you who have been in teaching know, that we test the kids and then 6 months later we get the results. So they're not really formative exams for our kids. They don't really help our teachers understand what's missing in their education. So it's a kind of like a thermometer, but it's a thermometer that tells you 6 months later whether or not somebody's doing well. When I've sat in with teachers who are going over the WKCE, the Wisconsin Concept Knowledge and Concepts exam, they're really never surprised about the results with their kids. They know their kids. They work with their kids on a daily basis. They're not surprised when there are kids who aren't doing well because they've already identified those kids. So these are tests that require an incredible amount of time, an incredible amount of money, and they're really not helpful to the teachers. They're used more as a stick rather than a carrot for schools. They're used as a punishment. And I don't think that it's really helpful to our teachers. Another thing that really concerns me, Marge talked about, and you mentioned from Julie's article, the attack on public education. The march towards privatization, I think, is the really, as Marge said, is key behind what's going on here. And I think the fact that our voucher schools in the state, which are held up as the kind of the holy grail for other states that started in Milwaukee, that has been changed. It's not just an opportunity for poor kids to go to a better school. Now middle-class kids who go to private schools are getting vouchers. And I'm sure that Madison is on the list for what's coming next, as is Green Bay and a couple other places. These schools are not accountable. They don't have to take everybody that applies. They don't have to deal with their special needs kids. They can accept them and then 3 weeks later send them back to the public schools and keep the money that they got from the state. So there are a lot of things wrong with our voucher school system. I think the other attack that I don't think has been mentioned yet is the attack on teachers. And to me, that's a big concern. I have one child who teaches in California, which is a terrible place to teach because they've been under Act, or they don't call them, thank you, Prop 13 for decades now. They have been dealing with the cuts that we've been dealing with even longer than we have. He loves what he does. His school has no money at all. The only reason why he has a projector that he hooks up to his computer is because he bought it. They have no money for things like that. And I think that that's really the crux of the problem. We're expecting more and more and more of our teachers. We have teachers spending an incredible amount of time disaggregating data, which they never were taught in education school, trying to figure out exactly where are our kids, each individual kids, where do they need supplemental help? They spend an incredible amount of time doing that, and it's important to know where the holes are in a kid's education. But we are not going to be able to recruit fine teachers a whole lot longer, I think, when they're vilified the way they have been. They've been told that they were the cause of the economic problems in Wisconsin, they and other public workers, which is totally not true. And they carry the burden for families who are struggling, as well as families who have very gifted children. And I really despair with the vilification that's gone on with teachers that we're going to be able to recruit the best and the brightest. Not only has their salary been cut, but they've been called all kinds of names. And that worries me as much as a lot of the other economic challenges to public schools.
I would like to pick up on one thing that you said regarding the increased poverty in a place like Middleton. I have an article here by Linda Darling Hammond, who is in the School of Education at Stanford. And I guess probably most of us are aware that the public schools have received a great deal of criticism because the standings and the test scores of our students compared with other nations, I think we rank 48th or 50th. And this is taken as an indictment of the public school system. She points out that in 2009, U.S. schools with fewer than 10% of students in poverty ranked first among all nations on the Program for International Student Achievement Tests in reading, while those serving more than 75% of students in poverty scored alongside nations like Serbia, ranked about 50th. I suppose one could oversimplify it by saying our problem is not educational, our problem is poverty. I know in Janesville, I think we now have close to 50% of the students that are on free lunches.
Yeah, I'd like to say a few things. Could I say something about the testing?
Certainly,
testing?
Please do.
Yeah, this is something that's always disturbed me about international testing. First of all, the countries that take these tests are some of the most homogeneous countries in the world. Finland. All right, let's think about Finland. How much diversity is in Finland? All right. Secondly, by the time students reach the age of 15 in Finland, in England, in France, in Germany, they're already Japan. They're already siphoned off. You will go into vocational studies. You will become the academicians, and you will do this. And those are the kids they test. That's the second thing. Third, I have taught in these other countries. My husband has taught in these other countries. And we both sit there and wait for some child to raise their hand and question what we're saying. Go into my middle school classroom in Cherokee, and you've got kids standing on the chair saying, I don't think so, you know, and you welcome it. In fact, the head of education in Singapore actually said in Newsweek magazine, when it was, you could still pick it up in your hand, and it said, he said, yes, our children can take tests. Your children can think. I carry around with me in my wallet a $2 bill from Singapore, $2 bill. Do you know what's on the front of that $2 bill? A classroom of children on their money. Think about that. We can't even fund our schools, and Singapore's putting it on their money. Is that, see the irony there? Okay. And I'm so glad that you brought up the fact that what our top students do are better than anybody else in the world. But nobody wants to talk about it. You know that, and I know. Look at our local newspaper. All they want to hear about is what's wrong. Nobody wants to hear about what's right. And we're still in there, and we're still hanging in there. And the latest research, and I wish we had our Dean of Students from Education, the latest research shows what poverty does to children. And poverty has increased enormously. There's permanent brain damage. I have never seen so many acutely needy children in our schools than I see today. Children that can only be one-on-one. And that costs $20,000 a student just for one-on-one. And we're getting funding less and so on and so forth. So I'll stop now, but it's not good.
Linda Darling Hammond is an icon for me. She was in the running with Arne Duncan to be head of...
Can you imagine what would happen?
The world would be a different place if Linda Darling Hammond, who liked teachers too much, that was why she didn't get the job. She is a very clear thinker about this poverty issue. There are things that we as a society need to come to grips with. One of them, Marge touched on, and Linda in her comments did, that the poverty rate is getting higher and higher. And this is leading to this huge achievement gap, which some of us are trying to rephrase as an opportunity gap. So Marge talked about kids coming to school, and I mean, we have kids coming to school hungry, we have kids coming to school without winter boots, kids coming to school whose parents haven't read to them, who might have a vocabulary of 4,000 words. And there are many things that the schools could be doing if society supported them adequately. And they're very, very simple things. And I jumped up and down when President Obama, in his State of the Union address, mentioned one of them, and that's access to high-quality preschool. That's something that can definitely help close the achievement opportunity gap. And it's something that both Madison and Middleton have done now, and that's to provide 4K. Really, if you read the research, 0 to 3 are the critical years. That's when so much formative brain development occurs. But at least let's start with 4K and have access to high-quality 4K for all our kids. And it should be funded adequately by the state. We need to have high-quality, well-trained teachers. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer. But we need to have teachers who are skilled in their fields, who understand all of the challenges that are bringing to bear. And our education schools are really trying to play catch-up with what they need to be doing with their teachers. We need to have access to high-quality curriculum. We need to have equal opportunity to technology and high-quality curriculum across the state. It doesn't matter if you're up north and you've got a district of 400 square miles and your kids are on the bus for an hour and a half every day. Those kids need to have access to the same things that the kids in Middleton Cross Plains do. If I had my druthers, and I assume that if Madison had their druthers, we would become lighthouses for communities. Our doors would be open at 7 o'clock in the morning. The kids could come in. They could have breakfast. They could shoot around a basketball. They could go to school. They could have a good lunch. They could stay after school, have a good snack. They could get tutoring. They could have activities that they wouldn't be getting at home. So the schools are really taking over for what the county used to provide and what the state and city used to provide. But we can't fund it. We can't even fund what we need to do right now for our kids. We still are living in an agrarian calendar. With an agrarian calendar, kids have 3 months off from school. There's a huge drop when the kids come back to school. Probably not my kids, and probably not Sandy's daughter, and probably not your kids, because we did pretty neat things with them over the summer. But kids who are not adequately cared for in the summertime, when the kids came back to school, it was catch up for at least 6 weeks. Where the kids are really struggling to get back into the groove of school, and they've forgotten a lot of things. So those are some of the things that we could be doing that we can't do now because there is not the funding for it. There's the will for it, but certainly not the funding.
I would like to make one comment, though, with regard to something that Marge said. That was with reference to Finland, which usually comes out at the top in the international rankings. As we all know, the attack upon the public schools has included vicious attacks on teachers that are organized into unions. Unions protect bad teachers, et cetera, et cetera. Finland is totally unionized. And they are a powerful union. And they work with the educational leaders to plan the education in Finland.
The focus that I have had in the legislature has been that of K-12 public education. And it was the reason I went there in the first place. I was recruited by the Democratic Party. It's been a huge struggle because the one thing I wanted to do day one and still want to do is fix the funding problem. And it's just, we go round and round and talk about it, and it just doesn't get done. And I don't think there's anybody who would say that Wisconsin's funding mechanism is good enough. It is broken. It needs to be fixed. People have varying ideas on how to do that, but we just never get to it. We keep tweaking it and changing it a bit and kicking it around, but we don't fix it. And that is so frustrating to me. I can tell you right now, in the near future, fixing Wisconsin's public school funding problem is not going to happen. What you are going to see is that it will get worse. And the part that I wanted to talk about today, or was asked to talk about today, was the voucher school situation. As I move around the state of Wisconsin and people come to testify here in the Capitol, and I get all kinds of mail and inquiries and so on, most people don't really understand what the voucher school is about. And when you go outside of Milwaukee and Madison and a few places like that and explain the voucher program, they don't believe you. because it is that outrageous. They think you're kidding or exaggerating. So with that, we'll just start with explaining that, first and foremost, I believe that this voucher school system, this effort to privatize public education, is much, much larger than Wisconsin, though it was born in Wisconsin. And it is clearly an effort to turn our public schools into profit-making, for-profit entities. Now, that is my core belief about the voucher program. There, I have seen nothing to dissuade me from that. And it's definitely directed at the unions. Some unions are sort of clustered around the country based on manufacturing, for example. But teachers are everywhere. So the only way we can get at the teachers' union is to destroy the public school. And I perhaps become cynical in my 11 years there, but that is my belief. That is what I think they're trying to do. Anybody disagree with me? The voucher program was born in Milwaukee. It was an idea from Representative, what was her name, Polly Williams. She and Tommy Thompson worked together clear back in the 90s, early 90s, 1990. And it started as a pilot program that included 200, maybe 300 kids, 7 schools. And it was her effort to provide opportunities for African-American children in poverty in her district to attend private school, because the schools they were attending were pretty bad. And I don't think there's anybody who would disagree that we have some very bad schools in Milwaukee in the public school system, and they need to be fixed. Fixing them, in my mind, is not to hand over a voucher to somebody to send them off to a private school where we have no accountability. This gets very complicated, so we'll just kind of head down this path generally and see where we end up. I can tell you today, this grand experiment that started in 1990 in 7 schools, where today we have about 25,000 kids on vouchers, anything that we can say about them in terms of real testing and understanding about what is happening in the schools is that there's no success story, none. At the very best, they come close to the public school students in the testing that we are allowed to do. There's just nothing going on that says this is worth what it's costing our public schools, and it costs our public schools dearly. Today we have 112, maybe 13 private schools. That varies from year to year. Right now it might even be 102. But out of those private schools, taking your tax dollars, and it used to be we would give the tax dollar to the parent and the parent would choose the private school. Today we just write the check right to the private school. 22 of those 100-plus voucher schools are 100% taxpayer student population. 100%. So without the tax dollars, they wouldn't exist. Now, to me, that's, I don't know, this challenge to the Constitution about separation of church and state and your tax dollars going into secular schools, I wish we could revisit that, because I just never was able to understand how we came to that conclusion. So 22 of them are 100% voucher students. 61 of them are at least 90% voucher students. 87 of them are more than half voucher students. I'm writing a bill right now that says if your school is 50% or more voucher students, you must become a public charter. That won't go anywhere. But it used to be the law in 93, clear back in 93, that was the case. You couldn't have more than 50%. There are only 3 of those schools that have 10% or less voucher students, which are truly private schools with a few voucher students. There's only 3 of them. They are not held to open meetings laws, so we don't know about their racial demographics. We don't know about their suspension rates, their admission policies. We don't know about their staff pay, who's on board there. We don't know who their boards of directors are, who the people are that run the school. There's just so much that we don't know about those schools and are not entitled to know because they are, quote, private. It is so night and day different from what public schools have to do. And the big picture from the balcony for me is that the private schools pretty much can do what they want. I mean, you do know that the teachers, we finally got it to the point where these voucher student teachers, school teachers, have to have a bachelor's degree. Up before that, that wasn't even the case. They didn't even have to have an advanced degree to teach children in these schools. Now they have to have the degree, but it doesn't have to be in teaching. They don't have to come prepared to teach. You can have a bachelor's in science or something and go teach math. We have no control over that sort of thing. And when you talk about this outside of the area where people, you know, are savvy about educational issues, they're incredulous. They just simply don't believe you. Public schools have to do so many things for students and are under such scrutiny. For example, every student who comes to the door must be accepted regardless of whatever challenges that student brings to a public school. We have students who are very expensive to teach in our special ed situations, and these private schools, these voucher schools, don't have to take them. They are supposed to take them, but they claim that they don't have the facility, and you know, they find ways to not do what they are required to do, and that's pretty much borne out in the statistics. They have less than 3% of their students being special education, where I think Milwaukee is up to something like 23% right now. Do you guys know what Madison's special ed population is? What percentage you have?
Wow, that's a very good
question. 16 or 17? Yeah, okay. Last session, we had AB 110, which in my 10 years in the legislature, I am going to title this as probably the most irresponsible bill I have seen come before the legislature, including, you know, the one where somebody suggested we arm teachers and somebody else suggested that. AB 110 is the special ed voucher school.
Oh, that. Oh,
yes,
of course.
Yeah, oh. Yeah. And this was brought to us by a freshman Republican who didn't know anything about the bill, but it was hers anyway. But it simply said that we were going to create a special school for special ed students, and the cost of teaching that child would go out the door of the public school to this school. But seriously, there was nothing about this school that gave me any confidence that the child was going to be taught in any way that you and I would consider to be responsible. The parents give up all rights, federal and state rights, to education issues for that child when they cross the doorstep and go in. And yet, I mean, truly, a totally uncommunicative child in a wheelchair could go into this school, and we have no knowledge of what happens to that child during the day. There's nothing that we could say or do that would give any assurance that that child was being treated well, much less educated. None of the teachers would be required to have any special certification in teaching or in special ed. No services were going to be required. We were just to rely on the goodwill of the school to want to do the very best for these special ed students. And the money that went with them out the door, we had no idea what was happening. I'm almost positive we're going to see that come back. If we are lucky, it will come back as a single bill before the legislature. I fear it may get rolled into the budget, where we have next to nothing to say about it, and it's just a done deal. Because that budget is going to pass, And I've had to vote for budgets where there were things I didn't like in it, and I was going to have to explain to some of my constituents down the road why I supported XYZ, and it's because it got shoved into the budget. And that's going to happen, I think. If not, and we get lucky, it'll be a separate bill. The reason it didn't pass last time is because there were a couple of Republicans who felt that, you know, this just isn't right for kids. It did pass out of the Assembly. It went to the Senate, and I will give Luther Olson credit for just not letting it move past his door. Otherwise, it would have passed. And the other part of that, there's just so much wrong with it, but the few things that kind of stick out in people's mind, if you've got a child, let's say second grade, who has a speech impediment, a slight lisp or something, that they receive special ed attention in our public schools. And maybe in 2 or 3 years with some speech therapy and so on, it goes away. It's taken care of. That child comes off the special ed roll. The money goes back into the pot, and the child just becomes, you know, a regular student in a regular classroom. End of story. In this case, when a special ed child leaves the public school, the money that was being spent on that child goes to the special ed school and stays for as long as the child is there. That might be 18, that might be 21, and we never get to revisit the cost of educating the child when they left. It's just gone every year, over and over. The irresponsibility of all of this just baffled me. I can't for the life of me understand how the legislators who brought it forward and supported it could go home and explain that to their constituency, except for the fact that most often the constituency doesn't know anything about it, doesn't understand it, doesn't know how to ask questions about it. So we have this huge job, which is trying to educate the public about these things. And trust me, the media is of little help, very little help.
When you go around the country and you study the bills for charter schools or vouchers, in every state in the union, it's the exact same wording in every state, written by ALEC. So is there a national agenda out there? Absolutely. Absolutely.
This became absolutely transparent when some ALEC legislation around education came up, and I can't recall which Midwestern state it was, but they had forgotten to change the state to the state that it was actually in. So the legislation was submitted with the wrong state named in it. So it's just boilerplate.
Yeah, we didn't say they were clever.
I would just like to add to that that ALEC is primarily funded by the Koch brothers.
I testified in front of the committee last year against charter schools, mm-hmm. and I came up with a scenario I'd just like to read to you.
Sure.
I don't know it by heart. It's my own words, but you think I would. I said, let's look into the future. Let's take the year 2025, for example. On one side of the educational spectrum, we'll see a mass of private charter schools filled with uncredentialed teachers and staff, unrestricted in curriculum and educational philosophy. Those students not chosen by lottery, because that's how they do it, will return to the dying embers of our public schools that have had essential funding drained from them for private charter schools. Add vouchers to the picture, and you will actually have the poor paying for the rich to attend private school. Those in the crowded, underfunded schools will not have their needs met. Crime and poverty will increase, and those needing the most from society will be getting the least. If that isn't a scenario for a great science fiction movie, I don't know what is. Can you believe half of this, Sandy? I don't know how you do it every day. Thank you for saying I've got a hard job, but you've got to go in and face these, whatever they are, people who are coming up with things that create and wreak havoc on our children and our schools.
When the voucher program began, it really was intended to be for families in poverty. Today, if you are a family of four making $70,000 plus, you are eligible for vouchers. And I believe that you add another 7,000 if it's a married couple. So clearly, and the children attending are no longer new students coming to private schools. They are kids that are already there. Or once a family member has been accepted into a voucher school, the rest of the kids, for as long as there are coming out of that household, are automatically there. And it's your tax dollar at a tune of $6,642 per kid per year that is going to that effort. Some of the things that I know are being looked at for this session, I know that the voucher school advocates have been whining because they haven't had an increase in their voucher payments for 3 years. And they want more than $6,642. We cut $1.6 billion from public schools last session in the Walker administration. And this group wants more money for vouchers. And you know what I think? I think they're going to get them, because Walker has been trotting around hinting that all schools will get an increase. I'm thinking that the increase to public education will be so small as to be of no help, and large enough that he can face the next election with, I gave money to public schools. And that's, again, I'm very cynical, but that's what I see happening. The voucher, special ed voucher that they were asking for was $14,000 per student, by the way. Right. That's with a guarantee of nothing. Guarantee of nothing. It is devastating to public schools. I mean, they don't have to do any of the things that public schools provide for kids. And I'm not saying public schools have to. It's part of the cornerstone of democracy in the state of Wisconsin that we have the quality public schools we have, with the quality teachers that we have. That's what makes us great. And to keep chipping away at that and taking money from it and weakening it, it's just so frustrating to me. And the outrage, I just wish there was some more outrage out there. And I know I speak in hyperbole when I do this, and people probably think that I'm exaggerating, but there should be outrage about what is happening to our public schools. And the accountability system now, where we're grading schools, it isn't an A through F grade, but if you can read through the lines, you know where a failing school is being described. The Walker administration, rather than coming in and helping those schools, wants to give extra money to the schools that are being successful at the cost of those that are failing, that are struggling. Right. And I swear, some of these people have not stepped into a schoolroom since the day they graduated themselves from eighth grade.
Can I say
but
one more thing?
The poverty, the English language learners, the transportation issues, there are so many things going on in schools that these people know nothing about and don't care about. Yes, go ahead, Marge.
Yeah, I was going to add virtual schools. Now, all of our homeschool families, whose money still goes to the public schools, whether they attend them or not, now they're going to take that money and give it to them for virtual schools. So we're losing money for that. Now, I'm not a terrible opponent of virtual schools if it's given for advanced study or additional studies or whatever. I am opposed to it if it's going to replace public schools, obviously, because I go back to the old Socratic method of teaching. You have a teacher and you have a student, and you have this interchange between teacher and student, which you don't have on a computer screen. And also, you don't even have to have licensed teachers doing the teaching on virtual schools. So we're losing money for the vouchers and special ed. We're losing money for virtual schools. We're talking about privatization. We're talking about poverty. We're talking about urbanization of Madison. Funding, because that's what's going on. And in addition to that, testing. There are two kinds of charter schools you can have in this state, a non-instrumentality and an instrumentality. An instrumentality is that public funds support the school, but the public school says, this is what you have to do, here's the curriculum you have to use, here's the testing you have to do, and then we'll give you the money. The other one is the non-instrumentality, and that's the non-instrumentality says, come on, give us the money, and you have no say, nothing. We take care of everything.
I have similar feelings about some of the things Marge said, but I think that there are ways for public schools to adapt to some of the challenges. I think that the best use of charter schools is to have a group of teachers who are very excited about trying something new and giving them the leeway to be able to try it and having kids voluntarily go into those schools. And Middleton has done a pretty good job of that. We've got a new charter right now that's a project-based community, and it's pretty exciting to see what's going on there. They're still held accountable to the same things that our students in our regular high school are, but these teachers are inspired teachers. I want to clone them. They've worked very hard to get this off the ground. It's still under the umbrella, and I think that the previous charter in that building was so successful with their way of teaching that a lot of that has migrated to the large 2,000-student high school. So the needs of those kids that were in that charter are now being met at the high school. That's really the ideal for charter schools. So I'm not anti-charter schools across the board. I'm also not anti-electronic schools. We've developed a hybrid method, a hybrid electronic school, where kids who have been homeschooled forever can get curriculum through our school district and a laptop, but they also are welcome in the school to take two or three bricks and mortar school classes, as we call them. So kids who are at home who are playing an instrument, it's pretty hard to be in a band or an orchestra when you're homeschooled. So they come in and they have access to our wonderful music program, or they take photography, or they take aeronautics, or they take advanced calculus, and they have that face-to-face with teachers. And actually, some of them are migrating back into the public school because they see we're not so bad after all. So I think that there are ways of dealing with the system, with the hand that we're dealt, and to take advantage, capturing families back into the public school, not losing the funding that goes with those electronic people who really want to keep their kids home for whatever reason, and take advantage of that and really help to educate those kids in the best manner that public schools can. And they actually do have face-to-face time with our teachers. All of our kids have real teachers that they have FaceTime with on a regular basis throughout the semester, as well as FaceTime on the computer. So it's not the same Socratic method, but I think more and more of our teaching, both in high school and in college, is going to be electronic, and I think public schools are going to have to adapt to that.
I would like to raise a question at this point. There's been discussion primarily on the funding and the politics of charter schools, vouchers, and so on. I don't think we should overlook the fact that the original excuse for these so-called reforms was because supposedly public schools were not really doing the job. I don't know, this book, Death and the Life of the Great American School System, Now Testing, or How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, by Diane Ravitch. Now, I think her work is particularly significant because when I was on the school board in Janesville, she was a strong proponent of charter schools. And I looked upon her as the enemy because I had my problems with charter schools even then. She and Albert Shanker, in the 90s, the president of the American Federation of Teachers, both supported charter schools very strongly. Shanker turned against him when it became obvious to him that the corporations and the large businesses had taken over the charter movement and were moving it into a profit enterprise. Ravitch looked at the results, and they showed her that the charter schools were a failure. And I cannot get her figures out of my mind. The tests that she referred to nationwide some of which came out of Stanford, in testing charter students and comparing them with the public school, 46% of the charter school students tested comparable to those of the public schools. 17% were actually superior to the public schools, and 37% were noticeably worse than the public schools. In other words, the whole justification for charter schools ended up benefiting 17% of the people. And Ravitch has, since that time, been on, if you will, a crusade against the charter movement and against the high-stakes testing, which unfortunately the Obama administration is pushing even harder than the Bush administration did. I wonder if we could have some comments from the other members on the panel on the results of all of this privatization.
Diane Ravitch is like a reformed smoker. She's just passionate about it, and she has a terrific blog if you are interested in following education issues across the country. I think charters and vouchers get blended in people's minds, and the accountability through being an instrumentality or non-instrumentality school, those are big words that confuse people. I think to simplify it, if public schools have jurisdiction, public schools, over not a university, not a county board, but a public school elected school board has accountability measures in place for their charter schools, I think that they are the potential for being a breeding ground for innovative teaching and innovative learning, and I support that. But I think when you take that accountability away and you have special dispensation that they're not accountable for, that they get more money, that they have fewer measures that they get, that they actually, the public can see that they're doing the job they're supposed to do, then I think that that's where the slippery slope is. And like Sandy and like Marge, I'm against vouchers. They have been very mindfully turned into subsidizing middle-class families and secular schools. Our public schools should not be undermined by money being taken away and subsidizing that for parochial education.
That's another thing you're going to see coming from the Walker administration is there is a notion coming from Alberta Darling that we should create a charter authorizing board for the state so that if this group went to the Middleton Cross Plains Area School District and said, I want to start this charter school, and they said, no, we aren't interested in that, they then could go to this charter authorizing board, appointees of the governor and the two leaders of the houses, which are all Republicans, by the way, who support voucher schools. They could then authorize that charter school, and it exists. And this came up last session, and there was a lot of outrage from the Republican legislators because Republicans have loved to wrap their arms around the local control mantra when it serves them, only when it serves them. So this kind of flew in the face of all of that. So that bill did not pass. I bet you we see it again, though. In some iteration, it's coming back so that, you know, governor appointees can authorize charter schools in your district, whether you want them or not.
Well, I think there are just a tremendous number of challenges to public schools, and I think engaged people like you can make a difference. I don't think that we should give up on public schools. I think we need to be really stalwart advocates of public schools and really try to encourage engagement with all of your friends and all of your neighbors to try to advocate for public schools and to be aware of all of these things that are coming down the road, like Sandy was talking about. So I would say don't give up. I haven't, even though I get discouraged a lot. But don't give up. And I think the more letters we write, the more emails, the more doors we knock on down at the Capitol, they notice. There have been efforts on the part of a couple organizations that I'm involved with, flooding certain legislators' boxes with emails on special topics. And even though we're not from their district, they sit up and they say, well, what's going on? Why is this such a big deal? So it's not all for naught. And we'll keep trying, won't we, Marge?
You bet. We spoke about a lot of things here today, but basically what this is all about is educating our children and continuing the kind of country we have into the future. And we've perhaps taken several steps back in my generation. I went into education thinking I could change the world, and I haven't succeeded as much as I had hoped I could. And I'm sorry, and it's not for lack of wanting, it's not for lack of teaching with the teachers that I did teach with. It just became an overwhelming kind of experience. But at least we had support in our day. At least parents still invited us into their homes for lunch or dinner. So the world has changed, and the pendulum will move back. I know it will move back. Remember, we were once the state of Joseph McCarthy, too. So it will come back, but at what expense? What are we going to lose by the time it gets back to that other side? And I don't know, and that's what we have to fight for every inch, everything we can do for these kids, and because all of them deserve the kind of education that you and I had in our public schools. They have to have that.
It's very heartening to see how many people care about public school issues right here in Madison, Wisconsin, and that's great. I want to encourage you to reach out to people outside of Dane County and have these conversations, even though you may not feel that you have solid ground understanding of charter, voucher, instrumentality, non-instrumentality. Bottom line is, there is an assault on public education, and it's brought to us by people of money who want to privatize. You know, let's take things out of the hands of government, put it into the hands of business so they can make money, and to hell with the results. We have to stop that. We just have to. And it's going to be up to folks like you to reach out and see to it that other people understand the situation as best as you are able to help them do that. I really wish I were more optimistic about our future. But with the redistricting that has happened, I think we are locked into Republican control for a good long time. I really do. Unless the people of Wisconsin wake up, and I don't know if the Walker recall didn't wake people up, I don't know what's going to. I wish we had a really strong Democrat to run against him in 2 years. I'm not seeing it. Sorry, I'm just not. So I'm not as optimistic as I wished I were. But I always feel better when I leave a group like this because I know that there are people out there who care. But more importantly, and I believe it was Ellen who pointed out, kids don't have a voice. It's their parents. It's going to take folks like you, grandparents who got a good education, who saw their children get a good education and now want to see their grandchildren get as good an education as possible in Wisconsin. And some of what we're seeing is good. Some of the reforms of public education that we are being pushed to look at and embrace are good. And so I don't want to forget that. The virtual school idea, I was 100% opposed to it till I went and I looked at one and I thought, you know, if I had a child with behavior problems or severe physical disability or whatever reason, and they could get an education at home, equivalent to that of the kid who was able to go to the brick and mortar, maybe this isn't such a bad thing. As a money-making tool for a school district, well, then we got a different story. But the thing you need to take away from this is that Wisconsin has a good public education system that needs to be protected. Right now, the enemy at the door is the voucher school. It's like the camel with the nose in the tent. It started in 1990. Right now, there's hardly a foot that isn't in the tent. And we've got to prevent that from happening.
You've just listened to a panel discussion, Public Schools Under Attack, Voucher, Charter, and Virtual, sponsored by the Madison Institute. To hear the entire two-hour talk with Q&A, or for other thought-provoking programs sponsored by the Madison Institute, go to our website at www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.